Basically, over the course of our lives, God is at work changing our minds. We're people who want to please other people so that we'll be liked. And what God wants to change our mind to is to please Him and to experience His love, His grace, His mercy.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
We are glad that you're listening today. Thanks for tuning in. We're going to continue in our series on what's it look like to be a believer. In other words, what's my life supposed to look like as a believer? We're looking at different areas that our life changes as believers. One is in our growing understanding of God, our growing understanding of God's creation, the world, other people, and a growing understanding of ourselves. And we're trying to break that down and look at that, those pieces as clearly as we can in little tiny steps. Today we've chosen to talk about the fear of God. And Jack, when I think about the fear of God, I remember being in a church when I was little, and I remember them saying, we need to fear God. And I thought that meant I was supposed to be afraid of God. And in that church, we were supposed to bow when we walked up the aisle at the cross before we walked into the pew. And I remember thinking that that's one way that I could be afraid of God, that when I didn't bow, that I was supposed to be scared of Him. That makes sense. So it's kind of a confusing term to me as a little child, and it's certainly developed since then. But having fear of God really does conjure up in my mind still this sense of being scared. And I think it is a kind of confusing term. What do we really mean by fear God?
Well, it is confusing because it's not like the notion of being scared of God is entirely wrong. I mean, that's why the term the fear of God is what it is, the fear of God. There's a sense in which we are to be scared of Him. Now, we completely misunderstand it if we think that we are just to go through our lives terrified about what's going to happen and what God's going to do to me. That is to completely misunderstand the God who is love, the God who is good, the God who in His mercy has sought me out to redeem me and so on.
Or if, like, I miss a beat, like I don't bow in front of the cross,
right,
then if I don't cross every T and dot every I, then I'm really out. And I need to be afraid of God because I guess underneath that is God's not merciful. God's just going to get me.
Right.
So I better be afraid of this guy that's going to get me.
And that would be to totally misconstrue what the Bible is saying. I mean, a couple of passages we can look at in terms of what it doesn't mean. I think maybe that, let me start there. In John, in his letter, 1 John talks about we have come to know and have believed the love which God has for us. God is love, and the one who abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. By this, love is perfected with us, that we may have confidence in the day of judgment, because as he is, so also are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves punishment. And the one who fears is not perfected in love. I think there the point that he's making is very much the one that you are making, that if we understand the love of God for us, then we are no longer going to be afraid of him. Because fear, he says, involves punishment, and there is no punishment in, how do you put it, there is no, but perfect love casts out fear because fear involves punishment. That is a mature understanding, that's what he means by perfect, a mature understanding of the love of God, understanding how deep and profound his mercy is, leads me to a point where I no longer need to walk on eggshells around God, fearing lest I slip and do the wrong thing and God lashes out in punishment. John is saying the mercy of God is so profound that we can relax with him, in a sense. It's a very similar thing that Paul is getting at in Romans, the 8th chapter, when he says, "You have not received a spirit of slavery leading to fear again, but you have received a spirit of adoption as sons by which we cry out, Abba, Father." The slave needs to worry about every step. Is he crossing his master? Because if he crosses his master has the power of life and death, punishment over him, and maybe he will get punished. A son, one who has been adopted as a son, is not going to forfeit their inheritance. Their father is going to give them a lot of slack because the relationship is secure, it's fixed, it's established, and nothing is going to overturn that relationship. That's more like the relationship we have with God than the slave-master relationship, Paul is saying. So whatever it means to fear God, it doesn't mean that kind of cringing terror that makes me walk on eggshells and worry about maybe I'm going to make a misstep and I can't expect God to cut me any slack. I've got to really watch out. That's not what it means.
Or I think what a lot of people think is there's kind of a quota. Or maybe they don't think about it in that way, but in a sense, that's what's behind it, is I've done so much bad that I've just gone too far, and God can't possibly love me now. You know, when I was a kid, I smoked pot. When I was a young woman, I sold drugs. When I was older, I had an affair with my husband, and now I've cheated in my business. And, you know, I've just done so much that God's forgiveness cannot cover this one now. I think that's not actually describing my life, but kind of the thinking of somebody.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think what John would say is that that's not a perfect understanding of the love of God. That's not a mature understanding of the love of God. Because a mature understanding would understand that the issue is not how many times have I flamboyantly expressed my sinfulness. That's not the issue. The issue is how deep is God's mercy, how deep and profound is his compassion. And it's unfathomable that we could never plumb the depths of how far God in his mercy is willing to go to forgive us.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's all I have to say. Wow.
Okay.
Good.
So that's what the fear of God does not mean. What does it mean? Here's a passage that I think gets at what it does mean. Let me read a context. This is in the 12th chapter of the Gospel of Luke. It says, "Under these circumstances, after so many thousands of the multitude had gathered together that they were stepping on one another, he, Jesus, began saying to his disciples, first of all, 'Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. But there is nothing covered up that will not be revealed, and hidden that will not be known. Accordingly, whatever you have said in the dark shall be heard in the light, and what you have whispered in the inner room shall be proclaimed upon the housetops. And I say to you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body, and after that have no more that they can do. But I will warn you whom to fear. Fear the one who, after he has killed, has authority to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him." And the one that he's referring to, of course, as the one who, after he has killed, has the authority to cast into hell, is God. That's the one to fear, he says, rather than fearing other people, other men, who the worst they could do is kill you. In that context, what he's talking about is the regard that I have for the impact that somebody else can have on my life. And he's looking at other people around me and saying, they can do things to me. They can harm me. They can bring destruction of one kind or another into my life. And what's the worst they can deal out? They could take my life. They could kill me. To that, Jesus says, well, then you really don't have anything to be afraid of there, do you? Don't fear that. I love this passage because it's so, the irony of it is just
incredible.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, huge.
But I'll tell you the one to fear. Fear the one who impinges on your life by having the authority to cast you into hell. Fear him. He's just simply putting it in perspective that my life is not about just life in this world. My life is about my eternal well-being. And the thing I need to really take care of is my eternal well-being. How do I take care of that? By being rightly related to God, the one who has the authority to decide what my eternal destiny is going to be.
And how do I be rightly related to God?
Well, wow, there's all kinds of things we could say about that. Ultimately, fundamentally, the most simple way to describe it is to repent of my foolishness and unrighteousness and pursue truth and righteousness.
Thank you very much. That was very vague. Okay, so let me clarify that some from my own perspective of what it means to pursue God.
Okay.
Bottom line, pursuing God means, you use the word repent, and I only can repent if I'm very aware of my need for repentance. And repentance is, from my heart, understanding in a very basic way that I am a person who is messed up.
Yeah.
Who's got a lot that's broken in me. The Bible calls that sin. Recognize that I'm a sinner. See that and don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't try to deny it. Don't try to minimize it. Don't try to change it. Look at it straight in the eye and say, that's wrong, and want it to be different, and cry out for God's mercy that I desperately need because I see the desperateness of the sin in my life.
Mm-hmm.
That's being rightly related to God at its core.
Yeah, and I would add to that, if all of that stuff that you described is a reality, one of the ramifications of that is going to be that I'm going to strive against that sin within me. I recognize that I'm looking at life wrong, so I'm going to strive to look at life right. I see that the values that have been driving me are the wrong values, so that I strive to make choices according to a different set of values. I see that the actions and behavior that I've engaged in is abhorrent. So I turn and I try to make my actions and behavior conform to a whole different standard. I won't always be successful because I am a sinner. I usually won't be successful, but not for lack of trying. I mean, it's important enough to me to have my life be about something different that I do everything I can to make it about something different.
And that's how I need to fear God, is to make those things important to me.
Because, right, exactly, because I realize that the only thing of consequence that can happen to me that could really destroy me is not being rightly related to God, not taking him seriously.
But in this passage you just read, it's pretty radical. If I am rightly related to God, if I am doing what's right in his economy, it's still possible that somebody could kill me.
Right.
And Jesus is saying, hey.
It happens.
Hey, not a big deal. But it is a big deal. It is hard for us. Ultimately, we need to see how much more, what God has in store for us, how much more important that is, how much more valuable that is. But Jack, I'm sitting here in this chair and doing what's right. Deciding to do what's right with somebody having a gun at my head is a really tough thing to do. If I know that I'm going to be hurt or even killed if I do that or I live my life that way.
Mm-hmm. But remember the bigger picture that we're trying to develop here is this growing understanding of God that's a part of what's called wisdom. You're right. We don't start off wise people. We start off foolish people. And part of our foolishness is our short-sightedness, that the only thing that I can see is, but if they kill me, I'm gone tomorrow. If they kill me, here's all the immediate fallout of me being dead. We're not looking at the long term. We're not looking to eternity. We're not looking to see that God has in store for me an existence beyond this world that's far more magnificent, far better anyway, and can take care of the people that I leave behind. None of that is really in view when we get overcome by fear of the people who have the gun or who have the weapon. As I mature in my wisdom, I get this larger perspective. And when I have this larger perspective just really firmly established in my mind, that's when I could really respond, kind of gracefully facing into risk and danger and going, you know, it's in God's hands. You know, whatever's going to happen is going to happen, but it'll be okay. Because they can't do anything to me that God doesn't want them to do to me. And the important thing is I'm rightly related to God, and that's really all that matters. It's not easy to come to that point, but it's ultimately necessary for us to come to that point. It's ultimately true. It's ultimately reality that I'm getting in touch with when I have that perspective. And in my maturity, I will more closely, more firmly grasp that truth.
Yeah, let me give an example out of my own life of a firmer grasp of that truth. That God loves me, that God is good, that God's in control. Therefore, some of my behavior changes because nothing that big is at stake. Usually, we're not faced with, if I make a decision, I may be killed. Certainly that does happen and may happen in our lives here, but that's not really what's typical in our lives.
Right.
More typical is perhaps the hurt or rejection or lack of
the disrespect or contempt of other people.
Right. It has been difficult for me to say that I'm wrong out of my fear of people and their response to me. As I mature, I'm more free to think and feel and value what I do, as I am less concerned about people's response to me. It isn't nearly as important to me as it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
What's become more important to me is doing what's right, and sometimes it's going to hurt, but I really just want to do what's right.
That's where it really the rubber meets the road in most of our lives is our reputation, our other people's regard for me. We don't want to jeopardize that. We want them to like us. We want them to respect us and to accept us and so on. And the problem is, and that this is what Jesus is getting at in this teaching and in elsewhere, is the problem is we're surrounded by a group of people whose value system is so different than God's, that by my lining up with God's value system and acting out of God's value system, I'm clearly going to jeopardize the regard of other people. They're going to think I'm a fool. They're going to think I'm ridiculous. They're going to think I'm a joke. And even worse, they're ultimately going to hate me. I'm you know, like Cain hated Abel and killed him. And John says in 1 John, why did he do so? Because Abel's deeds were righteous and his were unrighteous. That's why he hated him. That there's this kind of irrational hostility that the unrighteous have for the righteous. So when I declare myself with the righteous people, when I declare myself with God and begin to try to look at life the way God does and to value what God values, there's a whole world out there that's going to hate me for that, with an irrational kind of hatred. I have to decide, what am I going to do with that? Do I want to avoid their hatred at all cost? Do I want to make them happy with me? If so, ultimately that's going to force me to compromise my allegiance to God and His kingdom and His value system. I'm going to have to fudge there in order to keep the whole world happy with me. And what Jesus is saying is, wait, it doesn't work that way. You're either with me or you're against me. You either declare yourself with the kingdom of God and its values and face the scorn and the hostility of the world, or you decide you want to keep the world happy with you, in which case you've rejected me. But you can't have it both ways.
A lot of things are going through my mind as you're talking. Let me see if I can spell out a few of them, which are, again, implications as I see the fear of God in my life. I was saying that I'm becoming less afraid of what men think of me and more wanting to do what's right. But even after I said that, Jack, and listening to you, I started thinking that maybe part of that has to do, that wanting to do what's right, has to do with I have tested out doing what's right, say with my husband, and my husband just, he just loves me, and he's gracious. And so, in a sense, I'm more secure because I've been loved. Not because I'm just wanting to do the right thing, but it's indeed become safe. Now, it's still a good thing to do the right thing, but I don't think it's so noble that I have developed this. I also think I do the right thing, I think, a lot in my counseling. I do the unpopular thing a lot. But what's interesting to me is in doing the unpopular thing, it's what has made me a better counselor and has made people want to have, has made people seek me out. Which, if I had been safer, I would have thought, man, I'm kind of securing myself as a counselor here better and more people will want to come, and that just hasn't been the case. So I wanted to take some, wanted to say, oh, good, I'm doing, you know, I'm risking here the scorn or the contempt of other people. But I really can't take credit for that, because, at least at this point, because it's actually proved better for me in terms of my reputation and the love I've gotten. But there's this other area I was thinking of, and that's that I have aligned myself with McKinsey Study Center. And McKinsey Study Center, which Christianity at Work is a part of, is in some areas of our community seen as kind of a radical Christianity and doesn't have all, it's just not, it's not easy. Mm-hmm. It's not, lots of things we talk about at least weren't typical in my experience, my church experience. And so there's a definite group of people who are very positive about the study center, but there's also a negative group. I work with a lot of Christians, and because I am aligned with the study center, they may not want to come see me as a counselor or respect me as a person. Then, in addition, going on Christianity at Work and really making public what I think and what I believe even puts me at more real risk in terms of my ability to be a counselor in this community and have a job where I have an income. So this is a very good example of, do I fear what men think of me, or do I fear God and just hope that He is going to bless me? If He does, that's great. And if He doesn't, I need to be able to accept that also from the hand of God. But I really believe in what I'm aligning myself to.
Yeah, that's good. That's exactly what we're called on to do. You see the same sort of tension in 1 Corinthians. Paul is dealing with a group of people, who some of whom are kind of embarrassed by Paul. They just see Paul as, you know, there's this guy Apollos in their midst, who's a really intelligent rhetorician. You know, he's
a great speaker.
He's a great speaker and great arguer, great persuader, very persuasive and powerful man. Paul, by contrast, seems kind of nerdy, I suppose, by contrast to Apollos. And they're embarrassed by Paul's nerdiness. So they're kind of trying to distance themselves from Paul. And Paul addresses that, and his concern is not for himself personally. I mean, I think it seems you get all kinds of indications that Paul would readily grant that he's not as impressive a person as Apollos is. That's all fine and good. But the problem that Paul has is, but I have been entrusted with the truth of the gospel. I have been entrusted by Jesus, by God, with the truth of the gospel. What exactly is going on that you would distance yourself from me? Nerd that I am, I've got the truth. Are you distancing yourself from the truth? Would you prefer impressiveness to truth?
Well, yeah, lots of us would.
And lots of us would.
Certainly in my life, I fight with that. Sometimes I just want impressiveness. It just makes me feel a whole lot more secure.
Right.
And this world looks really real.
Right.
And sometimes God just doesn't look as real. And
right.
it's a continual need to remind myself of what's important. And I think coming back to what we're talking about today, who am I fearing?
Right. Yeah, that's the issue. What Paul is asking them is, who do you fear? Is it important to you by association to be seen by all your neighbors as cool and with it and sophisticated and intellectual? Or do you want to line up with just what's true and real and from God? Even if in doing so, you are risking the scorn of your neighbors. And how many of us, I mean, virtually all of us, feel the pull of that? We really don't like to be hated. We don't like to be disrespected. That's the real sting of all persecution. You know, the physical abuse is bad enough, but the real sting that's permanently and constantly there is, these people hate me. These people reject me. And that's the thing that we always feel in persecution.
Don't you think it's the bottom line of our needs that God made us to be loved, mm-hmm. to love and to be loved. And when we're not loved, it's really going up against a part of us that God made. And
yeah.
It's a fight. It's a struggle.
Yeah, I think
to not be loved, because I really do need it, and I was made for it.
Mm-hmm. And the world is withholding that from me. And we have two choices there. We can either go running after the world, screaming, love me, love me, love me. I'll do whatever you need. I'll do whatever you want. Love me. Or we can say, well, I guess I'm not going to get that. I guess God is withholding that from me, but I will serve him anyway. And those are the only two choices we have. We sometimes don't understand what Jesus taught us. Jesus said, count on it. It's inevitable. I promise you, the world will hate you. And we don't really always believe that, especially in modern American culture in recent decades. We've sort of got the impression that if we do this right, we can love and serve God and uphold righteousness and have our neighbors respect us and look up to us and love us, both. Mm-hmm. Both of those things can be true. Jesus guaranteed us flat out, I tell you, if you follow me, you're going to be hated. They hated me, and they're going to hate you. Count on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, for lots of us Christians, certainly myself, I've been immersed in a Christian community a lot. As it turns out, as a counselor, many of the people that I see are Christians. And many other people that I see that aren't Christians, they like what I'm doing in their life, and so people aren't hating me. My husband's a Christian. He loves me. Most of my friends are Christians, not all, but my friends who aren't Christians still like me. And so I've gotten involved in this world that I think is kind of unreal. I don't think it is. I know it is. It scared me a few months back when you, Jack, and I went to that class at a university and just were sharing. It was a class on spirituality, and we had been asked to share about Christianity. And the people there were very hostile to us. I remember just walking out of there pretty scared, pretty shaken.
Yeah, hostile in a civil sort of way. I mean, which is the worst kind of hostility. In a condescending kind of way, in a patronizing kind of way.
Oh, yes.
I mean, they weren't throwing rocks at us, but it was
no,
very
they weren't
clear
swearing
that they,
at us.
Yeah.
But they were had their hostility just brewing right there on the surface. And I think had not etiquette told them to not throw stones at us, I think we could have gotten stoned.
Mm-hmm.
And the things we were saying, I thought they were great. They were interesting. They were compelling. And yet these people had no ears to hear what we were saying.
Yeah, that's true. But I'm not sure you're as protected as you are letting on, though. It's true that within the Christian community, within the Christian culture, it's going to be different things that people are going to reject and show hostility toward. I mean, your belief in God, they're not going to be hostile toward that. Your belief in the concept of sin, at least in principle, they're not going to be hostile toward that. When you start getting specific about what you mean by that, however, even within the Christian community, you're likely to see some hostility coming along. Because in the Christian community, you have children of God and children of the devil. And the children of the devil who hate God ultimately and who hate everything that he stands for are not going to want you to get real clear about what the truth is. The clearer you get, the more you're going to meet some resistance and some hostility from them. So even within the Christian community, there's this tremendous pressure to watch how what I'm teaching and what I'm saying is playing. And
I mean, how people are responding to it.
How they're responding to it. And adjusting what I say to how they respond to it.
Well, you know, you're right, Jack. I'm thinking right now that they're one of the things that our community doesn't talk about as much is God's mercy as some other churches do. And I'm very, and some people have really let me know that. And I think it's right to talk about God's mercy, God's love, God's grace. It's right. It's very important. But we just don't happen to say that every time. But I'm very aware of that. And I want to talk about God's mercy because I think it's important, but also because I see this big hammer coming down if I don't.
Yeah, and you know, we have to get the right perspective on this. Every time I open my mouth, do I say things in exactly the right balance, in exactly the right proportion, in exactly the right way that is not misleading? Well, no, of course not. And so for someone to come along and say this piece was missing or this was out of balance or that wasn't clear enough, that was too vague, you know, is something that that all of us always need to hear who are in a position of teaching. But the problem is, how often, if someone comes to you, Christine, and says, you know, you're really out of balance here, you need to emphasize the mercy of God more, what are they really saying? Are they saying your pedagogical technique is not really up to snuff, you're not really teaching as well as you can? Or are they saying, the part that I really want to believe so that I can ignore the other is the mercy of God, and you're not letting me do that because you're emphasizing this other thing over here and are taking the mercy of God for granted. Don't take the mercy of God for granted. Preach that to me because that's what I'm going to listen to. I'm going to ignore the other stuff. See, if that's where they're coming from, then what they're really saying is, I'm hostile to the truth. The truth that you're presenting is a truth I don't even want to be true, and I don't want to listen to it, and I don't want to have to listen to it. I want to listen to this other thing instead. So stop it. Stop rubbing my nose in that truth. If you want to rub my nose in a truth, take one that's palatable to me.
Okay, there's those two options. There's also a third option, and I really agree that those two options are very, very much there. The third one, though, could be, I am so afraid that God's mercy isn't there. I'm afraid that I've sinned so badly, or I have experienced people as so unmerciful that I can't imagine God being merciful. So I get my sin. That's clear to me. I'm rolling in the mud over here, and it's awful. But please help me see mercy because I can't find it. Open right. That window for me. Help me see a little bit of light, because if not, I'm just going to despair. Mm-hmm. So that's another option.
Yeah, that's true. That is. And you can usually tell by how they respond. If you respond by saying, oh, yes, I definitely affirm that, you're absolutely right, that's the piece there, then they feel reassured. If they go on criticizing me and saying, no, but you really need to take some responsibility for your being imbalanced in your teaching, and they insist on criticizing you for not reassuring them in the area that they need reassurance in, then there's something else going on.
Well, and what's going on, it could be that they're afraid. It could be that they don't want to see their own sin.
Right.
I'm still going to buy both of those.
Right.
And they may be very, very afraid and just need to hear it about God's mercy and need to hear it a lot and are super sensitive to it because they are, again, drowning in their own sin. It's also true that somebody could say, Christine, you've got to say this, you've got to say this, you've got to say that, because they might affirm that they're sinners, but they just really don't want to hear that. And that's something they need to also hear. So it could go either way.
Okay.
Buy it?
I'm not sure, but...
Hey, I'm not going to win that one.
I don't know.
Jack, you're tough.
See, I guess what it comes down to me is, what I'm getting at is, where does hostility come from? And hostility can be rather muted at times and nonetheless be a very real hostility. Where does hostility come from? If all I'm really concerned about is, but is this other thing true? I can work that out and create that balance in my own head. I can remind myself. Now, I understand what you're saying. Some people are really not sure that it's true, and they need that reassurance. And I can understand that. I can accept that. But your reassurance should be the piece that I need. You know, I need to get this picture. I need to understand the truth. I want to know how to look at my life. Once you've helped them look at your life, as you respond to their questions and their insecurities and their fears and so on, that ought to be sufficient. What's going on when someone says, you did bad? You did bad by emphasizing the judgment of God. You did bad by emphasizing sin. Where is that coming from? There's a kind of hostility in that ought to be alarming to us, I think. If I'm the one that's hostile in that way, I should take a look at that and go, do I really not believe that it's true? Is that what's really behind that? I need to take a good, long, hard look at that and make sure that I'm on the right page, I think.
Yes, absolutely. I agree with that. And especially if there is hostility. But what if there isn't hostility at all to knowing that I'm a sinner and really embracing that? I travel with people so often into a place where they can't see good, Jack. They just can't find it. And these people are grasping to find some kind of light somewhere. And so it isn't a hostility. Oftentimes it's a begging to see good, and they cannot find it. And my reassurance doesn't mean diddly squat to them, because they cannot see it. Because they're blinded by whatever, by the pain that's gone on in their life, that's come from other people. I don't know how many people I'm talking to out there in our listening audience who understand what I'm saying. There might be a very small percentage, but I want to be their advocate, because many of that percentage show up in my office and they're not seen, they're not understood, and they need to be, because already they're so lost. So that's why I can't let go of this. That's why I keep pushing it.
Right. But had you preached a different sermon, would that have made any difference to them?
What do you mean?
I mean, well, what if the message that you had hammered home was the mercy of God rather than the sinfulness of humanity? If they have trouble seeing it, don't they have trouble seeing it at a level of their perception, of the level of their emotional response, their reaction? Your sermon isn't going to magically change that for them.
No, but it's the best they have. They're grasping for it.
Okay.
They want it. No, it doesn't. But hearing it has some encouragement, has some...
At least gives them some hope.
Maybe there's something out there, hope against hope.
Okay.
Hope that maybe there is hope, maybe.
Okay.
But they're struggling, and I'm talking about people who are really struggling, that want it and just cannot see it.
Okay.
But let's not go on here. I don't want to only talk to a very small percentage of the population only. We're talking about the fear of God, and I was trying to apply it to my work. A few minutes ago, I tried to apply it to my marriage. Can you, in your life or in your experience with people, try to apply this concept of the fear of God, either through employment or through relationships or through, I don't know, recreation?
Well, the place where I feel it most acutely is what we've already sort of been talking about. I was throwing it over onto you, but all of what I was saying to you applies to me. You know, my whole livelihood is people being financially supportive of me in my role as a Bible teacher, as one who proclaims what the Bible teaches. And there's a tremendous temptation to want to not alienate people, because they're, for two reasons. One, I want their respect. I want their regard. I don't want them to hate me. I don't want their hostility. I want their approval. But even beyond that, above and beyond that, if I were to alienate everybody, there wouldn't be anybody who would be willing to contribute financially to my ongoing ministry. So anytime a Bible teacher is in a position of having their financial support linked to what it is they're saying and how that goes over, how that's received, there's a tremendous pressure to adjust what I say or don't say according to how people respond to it.
That must be every pastor everywhere.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's an occupational hazard. Yeah, in the ministerial profession today. And it's very important that pastors of all people come to the position of having the maturity of fearing God, not man. That is, recognizing, take very seriously the heavy weight of speaking what in good conscience I believe is the truth, what in good conscience I believe God has revealed in His Scriptures, in the Bible, and teach that the way I see it, not teach it the way I think it'll be received well by people. And it takes a great deal of courage and maturity to fear God rather than man to do that.
Very much.
And I'm sure I have not been successful. I'm sure there are times where I have, as the coward that I am, watered something down or muted it or tried to make it more palatable because people weren't really buying it quite as enthusiastically as I would want them to.
Well, I'm thinking of another area, is that in parenting. I have realized over the years of parenting, my oldest is now 17 and a half, that I have done far more than I realized to get my children to like me. I see now as they get older the outcome of that. It's harder to see when they're very young that I'm doing that. And it wasn't ever very obvious to me. And I certainly didn't go out to do it. But as I look back now and as I see from a more mature perspective what I'm doing, sometimes it's just because I want them to like me and I won't draw a clear line. Rather than saying, this is it. If they like me, that's great. If they don't like me, well, God's going to take care of me. But I've got to do what's right by my children. And that is certainly a really big, again, occupational hazard of parents. Parents want to be liked. And unfortunately, a lot of our decisions can come out of that rather than doing what's right.
So what you're saying is, as a parent, as I stand before God, I need to recognize that my job, the job that's been entrusted to me, is to train and nurture my children in the way that they need to be trained and nurtured, not to make them like me.
Yes. Good listening skill, Jack.
Thank you. That's really a profoundly important example. I think that's great.
And do you see yourself doing that?
Oh, yeah, sure. It's so easy to give in, to cave in to their demands, because otherwise they won't like me.
Yeah.
And how destructive that caving in sometimes potentially can be. Mm-hmm. That's where wisdom comes in. What's the difference between caving into your child's demands and just simply delighting them with a good gift? They look the same on the outside sometimes, but it makes all the difference in the world what the really deep dynamics of that relationship are.
And Jack, it's so hard to tell. We went out and bought one of my sons a really nice bicycle. We actually got it. It had been used as a getaway car from a bank robbery, and then the FBI sold it to this bike store at a much reduced. They confiscated it from the bank robber, and they sold it to this store for a much reduced price. So I'm kind of justifying this a little bit, but nonetheless, it was an expensive, almost not used, you know, maybe 10 miles bike, and. I really struggled with, should I have said yes to that or not? And then, you know, now he wants to go BMX riding, and so you have to buy all the stuff that's for that racing, and that costs a lot of money, and it's so many yeses. And I really I'm not clear if I'm doing the right thing or not. And that's what comes up in a parent's life all the time, every day, constantly. It is really difficult to be a wise parent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is my hardest job by far.
Yeah.
Okay, so Jack, We have very little time left, so I'm going to ask you to maybe summarize what we've said about the fear of God here.
Well, I think basically two main points, that what the fear of God is and what it involves is taking God seriously enough to realize that there really is no one, no other being, no other reality that I have to come to terms with other than God. No one else matters by comparison. Nobody else can do anything to me of consequence. The only one who can do something of consequence to me is the one who has the authority to cast me into hell, and that's God. So I need to live under the utter seriousness of doing what's pleasing to God, which is doing what's right and good and true. That's what it means, ultimately, to fear God. It doesn't mean that I live a life cringing in terror, afraid that if I make one misstep, he's going to smash me. Because that simply doesn't understand who God is. That simply doesn't understand, have a mature, experienced understanding of the mercy of God and the grace of God. So we looked at a couple of passages where the New Testament bends over backwards to tell us there's a lot of room to breathe, a lot of room to relax in the love of God, in the mercy of God. So the fear of God is not in any way negating or nullifying that freedom that I have to just know that I have been forgiven, to just know that I am acceptable, to just know that I am a son of God, granted an inheritance in his kingdom. Once I know that, I can relax and I can enjoy my relationship that I have with him. But that freedom does not extend to not taking God seriously, and it does not extend to being able to have a cavalier attitude toward what's right and good and true. I can't do that. To fear God is to realize this game is a serious game that I'm playing here in human existence. I need to make my choice, either for God or against Him.
You've heard it said that a college degree is not what it used to be. It seems these days colleges and universities are charging more and offering less. That's one of the reasons why Gutenberg College was developed. While many universities brag about their massive size and huge student body, Gutenberg College thrives on the idea that big is not always better. A student should not become a meaningless cog in some big education machine. A student should have the chance to interact in a meaningful way with his or her peers and professors. At Gutenberg, classes are small. Interaction with other students and with faculty is high. And education becomes interesting as well as rewarding. Imagine having a deep discussion about Aristotle or Shakespeare, where your ideas are sincerely considered. Imagine struggling to understand the writings of Augustine and having a faculty tutor come alongside you to help, and you'll get a good idea of why Gutenberg exists. And yet, there are many other advantages to Gutenberg other than its size. If you want to know more about Gutenberg College and all that it offers, call 541-485-4801. That's area code 541-485-4801. Now, if you didn't have time to write that down, stay tuned. We'll repeat it again at the end of the program. Here again are Jack and Christine.
Jack, every week when we come to record this program, I am really pretty excited to do it. Even though we actually record on Monday mornings and it's early and it's the first part of the week, I like starting my week this way because I like learning what you're going to teach me, really, and what God's going to be teaching both of us through our interaction together. Mm-hmm. So it's been something that I've really wanted and loved to start my week out with. But ultimately, the decision has to be made whether or not we're going to continue this program. I hate to say that because I really do want to continue this program for the reasons that I've just stated and others. But it really does depend on the financial support of our audience. Last time we talked, Jack, you talked about the appropriate motive to give to any ministry. And you said that it should not be out of guilt, was one of the points that you made. I wonder if we could just build on that a little bit.
Okay. Yeah, I know sometimes when there's a ministry that I really respect and really appreciate, and they let their need be known that they have some financial need, I know I oftentimes respond with a significant amount of guilt. That's my initial response, because I want them to prosper, I want them to thrive, and I feel guilty that I have not been a bigger part of their prospering. An unscrupulous ministry could really exploit that and could really manipulate me if I were to let them. They can play on that guilt, and they can really kind of put that guilt in my face and ask me to do something about that. Well, the one thing I can do about that is I can get my checkbook out and I can write a check and go, okay, there, let me get rid of this guilt that I've got. But that's really not what we as Christians should want from one another. That there's two things that may be, where's that guilt coming from? If I'm feeling guilt because deep down inside I recognize that what I really want to do is spend my financial resources on myself, and I don't want to give them away to anyone or anything else. I want them for myself. I want to enjoy whatever this world has to offer, and I need all the financial resources I can get to do that. Then the guilt that I feel is appropriate. The right response to that guilt is not to get out my checkbook and write a check to the ministry. The right response to that is to look at my heart and make some decisions about what I want my life to be all about. And it's far more important that I do a personal assessment of my priorities and my values than that I write any checks to anybody. There's a different kind of guilt that we experience, though, and that is just the guilt of being finite. You know, I'm only one person. I only have so many resources. I look out there at the world at so many good things that are happening that I could support, and I can't support them all. And that guilt, of course, is just unrealistic. And I just need to get over that, in the sense that I need to accept my finiteness and recognize I'm not God. It's not my responsibility to prosper everything that deserves to prosper and everything that could prosper. So in either case, even if it's a bona fide, legitimate guilt, the appropriate response is not to give. The appropriate response is self-evaluation. And if it's this false guilt of being finite, the appropriate response is not to give, but the appropriate response is to trust God, that God's going to take care of everybody that needs to be taken care of, and that He will do that, and He's capable of doing that. So in either case, it seems to me that giving out of guilt is inappropriate. The right motive, I think, as I've said in the past, is that I've made a decision before God. I really want to be a part of making this thing happen. And that's a perfectly legitimate and noble reason to give.
And I would say, Jack, very often the reason we want to give in this particular situation, wherever we give, is because it has really been valuable to us. And so that's what I would say to our listeners today. If this has been very valuable to you in the development of your own faith, then this may be an appropriate place to give.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541 1-800-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.